Welcome to the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast, sponsored by WebSpy. It's August 30, 2009, and this is episode 206. Today we talk about dynamic range. Dynamic range can be a bit tricky to get your head around, and I hear conflicting views on just how much dynamic range our cameras can capture these days. There's some great resources online though to help us with this, and I add my two cents during this episode as well. Before we get into the main topic, I'd like to say a big thank you to our sponsors WebSpy, the internet monitoring, analysis and reporting specialists. Thanks so much to all of you as well that tweeted the message that I asked you to tweet last week to WebSpy via Twitter to show WebSpy that you're all listening and that you support the podcast. It really was just great to see you all step up and do those tweets. And I know that it also kind of went against the grain for a few of you as well. So really, I do appreciate it. I do need you to keep that up though. So if you haven't already, or if you feel like doing it again, please do open your favorite Twitter client and tweet thanks to @WebSpy for sponsoring the @MartinBailey Photography Podcast. To find out more about WebSpy and their products, go to webspy.com/MBP and use the discount code MBPWSY for a 10% discount on anything you buy. Dynamic range is one of those words that crops up a lot, but it's sometimes not fully understood. Indeed, I don't even profess to have a full understanding of all of the fine details myself, but I do know enough about dynamic range to be useful to me when making my own images, so I figured I'd share this today along with some general observations. In simple terms, dynamic range is the difference between the darkest thing and the lightest thing that your camera can capture and still retain detail in the areas, in that darkest and lightest area of the subject or the scene. I guess you could think of it as pure black and pure white, and then all of the gradations in between, because that's basically what will happen as you hit the boundaries. If you go slightly past the area where you're capturing detail, you'll go from pure black to pure white at the extremes. But most of the things in the real world have some level of texture and shade and tonal values other than pure black and pure white. If I'm photographing a white object, I'm going to want to be able to make out some texture in that object or the subject, And if I overexpose the subject, I lose that detail and the information recorded in the image becomes just pure white. I should mention that if you shoot raw, and you definitely should do if you care about the quality of your images, you can bring detail out of the highlights and shadows to the tune of around one stop over or underexposed. But this will depend entirely on you having some detail in the overexposed areas or the deep shadows. If you were to sample an area that's overexposed in Photoshop and find that the whole area is pretty much RGB values to the tune of, full FFFFF, six Fs, for pure white, then if that's there for any significant amount of your image, then there's no texture there, there's no detail, there's nothing. So no matter, even if you're using RAW, if you've just gone to pure white, then you're basically, you're up that creek without the paddle, as they say. The same goes for pure black. And if you've got really deep shadows and you're down to the 0, 0, six zeros in RGB values, again, it's all gone. We've spoken before about exposing for the highlights, and most of the time this is going to be true. If you've lost control of your exposure though, and for one reason or another, your histogram starts to clip, hitting the right shoulder, then you'll start to lose detail in those whites, as we just said, or whatever colour you're exposing for. And note that I do always suggest that you try to use the RGB histogram if your camera has one, because you can blow out one channel without the others. And that can look as messy, if not messier. So, do try to make sure that you don't touch the right shoulder of the histogram with any of the channels. The point is to try to get the brightest part of your scene close to, but not touching, the right shoulder of the histogram. When you do this, though, if the lightest and the darkest values in your chosen scene are greater than that your camera's dynamic range can handle, then you're going to start to lose detail in the shadows. You know, if your dark areas start to plug up on the left-hand side of the histogram, then you know you'll start to lose detail in there. There are times when you'll allow large parts of an image to blow out, though, for the sake of the main subject. And we'll look at a quick example image here, which is number 2308. Here, the histogram, I'll include the histogram in the blog post for this as well. But here, the histogram will spike to the right, and, you know, we'll well and truly see that, you know, the highlights hitting the right shoulder of the histogram. But when shooting this, I knew that the sky was going to be blown out, and so I chose to ignore the histogram. I concerned myself only with getting the nicely exposed fresh green leaves, you know, as looking like they are. Had I exposed for the highlights, not only would the greens have been muddy, the bark on the tree trunk would have been very dark and probably even underexposed. You have to be careful here, mind, because when you do allow the sky to overexpose like this, it will gradually start to bleed into the important parts of the main subject. I like the effect here to a degree, and you know, as you can see in this image, I think that it adds a little bit of sparkle to the overall effect, but there are limits, and if you ignore the limits, and you know, say you've got a really bright light source, if you ignore that too much, it can bleed into the main subject to the point that it becomes badly washed out, or you know, there's just a total lack of contrast. Before we can start to talk about how much dynamic range our cameras have, let's look at the units of measurement used. Dynamic range is often measured in EV or exposure values, which can be also termed a stop. One EV is one stop in exposure terms. We know that there are three settings on our camera that affect the exposure, and that's the aperture, the shutter speed, and the ISO. Changing any combination of these three things will modify the EV. The chart to the right on the blog, if you go over to the blog at blog.martinbaileyphotography.com, is basically an EV chart. And this shows the shutter speeds required for each aperture from F1 to F32 to capture a subject with the exposure values from a range of minus 6 EV to 23 EV. And this is at ISO 100. If we were to create a chart for ISO 200, basically all of the shutter speeds across that chart would be halved. And of course, halved again for an ISO of 400 and so on. An aperture of F1 is basically a lens that has, it's as wide as it is long. And what I mean is, you know, if you have a 50mm focal length lens, to make an F1, an F1 aperture lens, it basically would need a 50mm wide aperture, so the same as the focal length. And that's when it's wide open, of course. The common 50mm F1.4 lens has an aperture of about 36mm when used wide open. And you know, this is how you calculate the f-stop, the widest f-stop. And you get that, of course, by dividing the f-stop by the focal length. And so if we divide 1.4 by 50, then you get 36mm. If you close the 50mm down to f2.8, then the aperture will actually be closing down to around 18mm or so. Again, just dividing that 50 by 1.8. Another example that I like to use to emphasize this calculation is the 600mm f4. If you divide 600 by 4, then you get an aperture opening of 150mm or 15 centimeters, which is about 6 inches. And you know, that sounds pretty wide, but if you've ever looked into the barrel of a 600mm lens, then you'll know that there are some pretty huge lens elements in there. But you know, I think we're getting off subject a little bit here. If we start thinking about this from F4, you know, because the most I would think that the widest lens people are really using is things like a 50mm f1.4. So you can see from the chart that at f1.4, an EV of 1 requires a 1 second exposure. As you increase the exposure value, you can see that the shutter speed halves with each stop until you get to the fastest shutter speed for most cameras on the market today, which is 1/8000th of a second at EV 14 with the aperture of 1.4. If your scene is brighter than EV 14, the only way that you can shoot without overexposing it is to close down the aperture, or if you don't want to do that, say because you want to shoot wide open for a nice shallow depth of field, then you can also add a neutral density filter to cut down the light and in turn reduce the EV. I hope I'm making sense here. I don't want to go into too much detail about this. But basically, you know, what I think you should do, if I am not making sense at the moment to you, then go over to the blog and do take a look at the EV chart on the blog post for this podcast. Because it's pretty straightforward. And if you can see all of these things in relation in that chart, it'll probably make more sense. So how much dynamic range, you know, do we actually have in the world around us and then the camera itself? The human eye can see around 24 stops of dynamic range because the pupil opens and closes dynamically as we scan a scene. If you think about it, you know, we're pretty much stuck in shutter priority mode. We even have an automatic ISO if you think about it. But, you know, basically, as we look at the world around us, if we look at something bright, then the pupil gets small to stop the bright area from being too bright, and in our cases, even the possibility of damaging our eyes. And then if we look into the shadows, our pupils open up to reveal more detail in the shadows, even at the expense of some of the bright areas in our peripheral vision. When you open your eyes at night, say, you know, when you're laid in bed, you'll probably notice a lot of grain, and the world's pretty much black and white because basically, you know, you lose the ability to record the colours and the tonal values in, you know, the higher. Basically, I don't know exactly what this is doing to the dynamic range, but basically, our brains are set in a higher ISO, and so, you know, you actually can see grain in your eyes as you get to that. Again, I'm digressing a little bit. But basically, you know, in a normal sort of scene where you've got, you know, strong highlights, lots of contrast, deep shadows, our eyes are generally working to around 24 stops of dynamic range. And that's in our full auto sort of automatic pupil opening and closing. But if we could actually stop the pupil from opening and closing, then essentially like the camera does, making one frame and everything in that frame is set by the same aperture, then it's estimated that we see between 10 and 14 stops. If you are wondering where I got this information from, I actually looked this part up from a great website called cambridgeincolor.com, and they have a great article on dynamic range there, which I'll link in the show notes. I'm sure by now, though, those of you that have never investigated this are wondering what dynamic range a modern digital SLR camera has. And, you know, basically sit with single images. Let's look at a few examples here. The 5D Mark II is said to have a dynamic range of just under 12 EV. So it's actually very similar to the human eye if we were to be able to close, you know, to stop the pupil from opening up and closing down as we look at across the, you know, the various contrast range of the scene. Like the human eye, the camera's dynamic range reduces as you increase the ISO. The 5D Mark II captures just under 12 EV when the ISO is set between 50 and 200, and as you increase the ISO, the dynamic range basically decreases, as does the tonal range of the images. And it's not a rapid decrease at first, mind. You lose just under 2 stops to around 10 EV as you drop down through ISO 400 to 1600. And then another EV for every stop from ISO from then on. And that means basically that, you know, you drop to 9 EV at ISO 3200. and 8 EV at ISO 6400, 7 EV at 12,800, and just under 6 EV at 25,600. And this data, by the way, I'm getting this from DXO Labs' website. They have a great website called DXO Mark. And if you want to see all kinds of information on your own DSLR, go to dxomark.com and select your camera's brand and model from the pull-downs on the top page. I also checked the information for my 1DS Mark III, and I was pleasantly surprised to see that it actually beats the 5D Mark II just by a hair with a dynamic range of 12. The 5D is just under 12. And Nikon users, you'll be pleased to hear that the D3X has a dynamic range of 13.7. And the D3 and the D700, as well as the D3X, all beat the 1DS Mark III and the 5D Mark II on the dynamic range. The good thing is that we all beat the Hasselblad H3D1150. And the sad thing is, the only camera that beats both the top of the range Nikons and Canon DSLRs as of August 2009 is the Phase 1 P65 Plus. This is a 60 megapixel medium format camera though, and it'll cost you in advance of $40,000 US for a basic kit including an 80mm lens, so I don't think many of us are going to be losing sleep over this one. Now, I know that some of you will be jumping up and down in your seats right now saying, you know, that you want to talk about high dynamic range, but we're not going to get into that today. Yes, you can shoot multiple images or use multiple exposures from a single RAW file to create images with higher dynamic range than the current technology allows. And there are even cameras coming out now that do HDR in camera. But I personally don't really shoot HDR. And you know, those of you that have been listening for a while know that I only like to talk about the things that I either do myself or have pretty much got a good understanding of. When you think, though, that modern DSLRs are now capturing roughly the same dynamic range as the human eye with a fixed aperture, do we really need much more dynamic range? I'm going to play devil's advocate here and suggest that we probably don't, or at least, you know, not in every situation. I believe that the image above, the one that we looked at earlier, was enhanced by the sparkling highlight shining through the leaf canopy. There are going to be times when the contrast in a scene is simply too great, and I'm sure that we'll enjoy it as camera manufacturers find ways to increase the dynamic range of the sensors. But you know what? When that happens, I definitely see myself grabbing the black slider in Lightroom and deepening my shadows. I don't think that we necessarily need to see detail in shadows in every image. Take a look at image number 2333 here. This white flowering lotus stands out beautifully against a dark shadow background formed by some of trees in the late afternoon. And the only thing that was, not pretty much black here was, that area that you can see. There's a bit of grey. I've converted this to black and white. So there's a bit of grey there in the middle, just to the right of the seed pod. And I think that was basically a tree trunk or something on one of the trees that was catching enough light, to sort of raise the exposure up to take it out of the shadows. But this is pretty much as my camera recorded the scene, except, of course, that I've converted it to black and white. If my camera was capturing, say, 24 EVs, double what it is, like our eyes with their automatic aperture control there, although it would be nice some of the time, and I really think that there'll be occasions where it'll just be too much. I don't think it will be that natural for us. I imagine that the images will look to a degree something like HDR images do now. And like my friend John Shear that we had on the podcast a few months ago. Some people are making beautiful HDR work, and I'm in no way trying to bring that down or pull that down. But there's no denying that a lot of the time it looks slightly unnatural or like a fantasy world, no matter how well it's done. And so, I just think that I'm not sure that I want that to be the default as the manufacturers increase the dynamic range of the cameras that they make. I, for one, am probably going to want a custom setting or something so that I can sort of, you know, tell the camera that, say, when I'm in live view, I want it to restrict what it shows me on the screen to 12 EV. Or maybe sort of, you know, any incremental value, probably controlled with a slider, for example, but any value between, say, 12 or less, up to the maximum EV that the, you know, or dynamic range that the camera can handle. And I don't necessarily want to see the full gamut on the LCD. That's my point. I can see most of it through the lens, of course, because I'm using my 24 EV dynamic range eyes. But I feel that the feedback that we get on the LCD, either in live view or on the image that we've captured when we're previewing it, can help us to use the shadows to effect. And I fear that, you know, we could lose some of that if dynamic range gets too great in every image. Of course, we would adapt, and it may just become another aspect of the photograph that we pre-visualize. You know, we shoot with all of the information anyway. We definitely don't want to restrict the camera from capturing all of the details that it can capture. So, you know, if the manufacturers come up with a camera that has a dynamic range of 24 EV, you know, for sure, I'm going to want to capture every image with all as much detail as possible. But as an artistic option, you know, I am, like I said, I'm probably going to want to sort of grab that black slider in Lightroom and just bring it up to sort of plug up the shadows and give us images like the ones that we've just looked at, the flowering lotus. Now, I've got a couple of other images here that I've not really managed to work into the podcast, but I'll put a few more images into the blog post just to sort of show you what I'm talking about here. The dark background with a well-lit foreground or object, you know, other things in the image can work really well. And I just want to be able to continue to sort of to create images like that. And I'm thinking that, you know, possibly if we do develop this as a pre-visualization skill, then it probably won't matter how big or how much dynamic range we get. We'll figure this out. But, you know, right now I'm thinking that it definitely helps me when I'm looking at things in the previews and that to just sort of to figure out, you know, how effective a really dark background can be. So just like I say, playing devil's advocate and just asking the question, do we really need much more dynamic range as a standard? And I'm, you know, I like the deep shadows that we get in some situation in today's cameras. And hopefully, you know, this will just give you a little bit of food for thought as well. So I hope that you enjoyed that, although it might have been a little bit heavy going at times. At least for me, as soon as numbers start coming out, I usually just glaze over. I was only ever any good at remembering numbers, you know, with relation to things that I'm interested in. You know, if the subject's like photography or computer science, I'm okay with numbers. But apart from that, if it's something I'm not interested in, they just go straight over my head. There are just a few things that I want to cover before we finish today. First, I'd like to thank everyone that has joined the Martin Bailey Photography page over on Facebook. Not only is it great to hook up with people over there, like I said last week, I know that there are some people, you know, we have our preferences as to where we want to, you know, get involved. But basically, you know, we passed 100 in this first week, and so I was able to claim the name Martin Bailey Photography as the page. So we have a link that is basically just Martin Bailey Photography, all one word now, instead of that silly sort of ID number thing that you have stuck on the end when you haven't actually claimed the page. So thanks very much to everyone for getting involved there, and especially over this last few days where I sort of made a note of that on Twitter, and then all of a sudden like 20 or so people instantly signed up, which was really, really helpful. So thanks very much for that. And we're going to make a go of that page as well, and just another way of keeping in touch. I also wanted to thank Outdoor Photo Gear for putting together a great workshops page to help photographers showcase their workshops, and for allowing me to include details of my own workshop in Hokkaido. There's a link to the workshops page in the toolbar at outdoorphotogear.com if you're interested in taking a look. And I suggest that you do, because there's already some other great workshops up there, including Rick Salmon's. So I'm very sort of, you know, proud and honoured to be on the same page as Rick. On the subject of workshops, I should also note that we now have just two places left for the Hokkaido workshop in 2010. The Snow Monkeys and the Hokkaido Landscape Legs still have a couple more slots, but there's a hard roof of 12 participants. So if you're thinking of joining, including the Hokkaido Wildlife Workshop, then please do so soon before we totally fill up. If we do fill up, I'll definitely start taking names for a cancellation list. But you know, if you really want to go, but you're just sort of holding back for one reason or another, if you can sort of, you know, get all of that sorted out and drop me a line, that'll be great. So thanks once again to our sponsors, WebSpy, and please do tweet that message to show your support. I really do appreciate it. And that's it for this week though, and I'll be back next week with another Martin Bailey Photography podcast. And in the meantime, you just have a great week, whatever you're doing. Bye-bye. The Martin Bailey Photography Podcast is a proud member of the Photocast Network. Find this and other great photography podcasts at photocastnetwork.com.